Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Fred Rowley. I'm here to chair, and I'm here to introduce this session on dysfunctional insurance systems. Those of us with experience in life insurance companies probably think immediately of IT on hearing that title, but I'm not sure Sean is going to tell us about that. Let me introduce Sean O'Ferris. Sean is a senior lecturer in actuarial studies at Macquarie University. Research interests include enterprise risk management, prudential regulation, and the history of insurance. I know she's done a couple of studies of the equitable that are very interesting to see. She teaches the control cycle subjects at Macquarie University and has written several case studies to illustrate problems in solvency management, and there was a very good one I have in mind in relation to the US banking system. So without further ado, I welcome Shauna to the platform. She's going to talk for about 30-35 minutes, and then there'll be time for questions at the end. Thank you all.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks for coming today. I'm going to talk to you a bit about what I did during my holidays, basically. One of the advantages of being at the university is that every now and then they give you sabbatical, where basically they tell you to go away and learn new stuff, and I had sabbatical last year, so... During my sabbatical, I decided I'd try and find out everything I could find out about the subprime debt crisis, which was really easy because there's about 20 different books already written about the subprime debt crisis. And every book had a different perspective on what exactly caused the problem. But a lot of the terminology that came up in these books was familiar to me as an actuary: moral hazard, asymmetric information, adverse selection, agency risk, and so on. All of those things are things that we're familiar with in our actuarial studies and we've come across before. Anyway, it was kind of hard to put together all these different perspectives on what went wrong. Everyone had a slightly different slant on what was going wrong. The other thing I was doing during my holidays was sabbatical, we're not allowed to call it holidays, looking at the history of insurance. So I was reading up on the history of insurance and in particular a particular shipping crisis in the 1860s, a problem with the marine insurance industry. And I saw exactly the same kind of problems coming up again: moral hazard, asymmetric information, adverse selection. And the shipping crisis was actually had quite severe consequences in England, which was the centre of the shipping industry. So I thought, okay, I can see there's a lot of similarities between what went wrong in these two different situations. So what I'm going to do is build a model, a very simple model, no high-powered mathematics in it, of the simpler case from 1860. Try and get some idea of how and why a system doesn't work. These were two systems which were very dysfunctional and actually caused a lot of distress to the societies that they were in. Look at how they solved the problems back in the 1870s. What solutions did they adopt that worked? And use the model that I've built to try and evaluate some of the proposed reforms that might prevent the same thing from happening again. So I'll start with just going back to 1866. And one day, a bottle washed up on shore somewhere in France with a message in it. It said, "Farewell, father, brother, sisters, and Edith." It was the man's daughter. His ship was going down, and he said the reason is the ship was overweighted with cargo. Water has broken in and was flooding through the ship. There had been a storm, but it wasn't really too violent a storm for a well-ordered ship. God bless my little orphan. And it's really quite a sad story because there were 270 people on this ship. It was full of migrants going to Australia, mostly Australian, a lot of Australian citizens. And they knew the ship was going down about a day before it went down. So all the families with their small kids on the ship were writing farewell messages and giving their kids their last hugs before the ship went down. There were only 16 survivors. Now, the main reason it went down was because it was grossly overloaded with iron that was going to be used to build railways. And the reason why the ship was overloaded, of course, was because it was fully insured. And the owners of the ship had absolutely nothing to lose and possibly something to gain if the ship went down. So this, unfortunately, was not atypical in the British shipping industry in the 1860s. This graph shows, the line shows the number of sailors' lives that were lost within 10 miles of the shore off England. And as you can see, it was up to 1,800. It was as low as about 800 in 1864, but peaked at more than 1,800 by 1867. So there was quite a large number of shipwrecks. And there were thousands of lives and millions of pounds lost as a result of this. And why was it lost? A lot of people said it was because of the insurance industry. And the sailors themselves understood that there was a connection between insurance and death. This is a song that I'm not going to try and sing it for you. you should be grateful. this is a song that people were singing at the time. There was a time when greed and crime did cruelly prevail and rotten ships were sent on trips to flounder in the gale. When worthless cargoes well insured would to the bottom go and sailors' lives were sacrificed that men might wealthy grow. And a guy called Samuel Plimsoll, who was a member of parliament, wrote a book in 1873 trying to work out what were the main causes of these terrible increase in the number of shipwrecks. And it's actually a book that has an awful lot about insurance in it. He tried to look at the financial incentives which led to the increase in risk-taking in the shipping industry. So we look at what was happening back in the 1860s with the ship owners. They were deliberately taking on more and more risk. And they had a lot of control over the risk that the ships were taking. And in first-year actuarial studies, we teach our students, moral hazard increases whenever the insured has a great deal of control over the level of risk. So ship owners could increase their risk of their ship by overloading it, just making it carry so much cargo that it was traveling deep in the water. Cost-cutting on their crew. Instead of putting 15 sailors on, they'd only put on 12, so when a storm came up, there weren't enough people to keep the boat under control. Cost-cutting on maintenance, not doing necessary repairs. And believe it or not, they actually deliberately constructed unstable ships. In some cases, they cut ships in half and then added a bit in the middle to make them longer so that they could carry more cargo. But, of course, that made them quite unstable. So, of course, we can see the analogy with the recent subprime debt crisis with home lenders. The home lenders were deliberately taking on more risk. They were overloading their customers by having really high loan-to-value ratios, having really high ratio of repayments to income. They were doing a lot of cost-cutting, trying to save money by having low-doc loans, skimping on property valuations, and product design. They were deliberately designing products which were highly unstable, adjustable rate mortgages and negative amortization type loans that they knew were unstable, but they seemed profitable in the short term. So I think the first symptom of a dysfunctional insurance system is when the insured has a great deal of control over the level of risk. So because I wanted to build a little model of this, I defined the load as being all the risk factors which are under the control of the insured person. And Q, that's the probability of a shipwreck, is just a function of the load. So the function I developed, and most of these numbers were made up, there's not very much actual data on 1860 shipwrecks, so a lot of it's pretty sketchy here. I tried to develop, and it's really just, this is just an illustration of how we could build a model. A load of 100 is fairly safe, less than a 1.5 probability of shipwreck. But if you go up to a very high load, like about 150, the risk could be 2 or 3 times higher. Okay, so if we're going to model this, we need some kind of model that shows the relationship between the risk and the amount of the load. So why did the ship owners overload? The answer is obvious, because they were going to make a lot of money doing overloading, right? This is a quote from Mr. Plimsoll's book. When you consider how small an addition to the fare load of a ship will augment the profits of a trip, 25% or even 50%, you will easily see how great was the temptation, especially in settled weather, to add the extra weight. And he goes on to point out that really it was a function of the leverage. There were a lot of fixed costs in any ship. If you increased the weight by 10%, you'd double the profit. If you increased the weight by 20%, you'd triple the profit. So leverage was an issue in a dysfunctional insurance system even back in the 1860s. And he said, given the profit incentives, of course people were going to overload. So the next thing we need to look at in our model is we need to have a model that shows how much profit the insured person can make by overloading. So the ship owner's decision on the load level, he will be affected by the profits he can make. So in this model I said he owns a ship that's worth an amount S. He's going to borrow an amount L to fill up the ship with the load. And he's going to make a profit margin of M dollars per unit load. So if the trip is successful, his wealth will be he'll own the ship, plus he'll have the profit margin on his cargo. If the voyage is unsuccessful, he'll have no ship, no profit margin, and he will still owe the amount L dollars that he borrowed to buy the cargo. I'm not allowing for any insolvency put. I'm assuming that he will actually repay the loan instead of just bailing out. So better model would probably have some option to not repay all of the borrowed amount. So second point, moral hazard increases when the insured both controls the risk and he can make large profits from increasing the risk level. Okay, so combining the two models we had, it's very easy to work out what load would the ship owner choose if he wants to maximize his profits. So the peak of this the bottom line is the load level, and the line at the vertical axis is the expected profit. So if he's going to maximize his wealth, if he has a 10% profit margin and the ship's only worth $10, he would end up with the bottom line there, the pale blue line. He'd choose a load of 133. If we increase the value of the ship, that means that he has more to lose. You can consider the ship as being like his minimum capital requirement. If he's got more to lose, he will be a bit more conservative in his load level. And if the profit margin goes up, he has much more incentive to overload, and in this case, if you put M up to 20%, his optimum load goes up to 157. So it's very sensitive to the expected profit margin. So I guess in the subprime debt crisis, you have to think, how much extra money were these guys making by taking on these extra loans? And that's a key factor in their decision to overload. Of course, most ship owners would not choose to maximize their profit because that would have quite a high probability of shipwreck. If you did choose a load of 133, you'd have a 2.5% probability of shipwreck. And if you just owned one ship and that was your livelihood and you lost it, that's a pretty unacceptable risk. So what I did was put in a utility function in to model some risk aversion there. And according to Mr. Plimsoll, before the introduction of the insurance market, most ship owners were really quite conservative and very safety conscious. So I chose a parameter for the utility function to make it so that the ship owner would choose a fairly safe load. So I guess you can think of this as being an analogy to the days when banks made home loans and they couldn't sell them to anyone else. They had a very conservative policy on lending because they were going to bear all the risk themselves. So the load level that would optimize utility, maximize the expected utility, would be 103. So 100 is about a safe load level in this model, or as safe as you can get. There's always some underlying risk. Okay, so next thing we say is let's build in some diversification benefits. Suppose that the ship owner can reduce his risk by, instead of just owning one ship, owning 5% of 20 different ships. That will, of course, change the risk-return trade-off, and the natural effect will be that the optimum load level will increase. And in Plimsoll's book, he pointed out that the people who were most likely to be overloading their ships were often the owners of large fleets of ships who could diversify their risks more easily. But the amount of the diversification benefit will depend on the correlation between the risks. If the ships are all independent, you can get your risk down to almost nothing. But they're not all independent. So next thing we have to look at is what causes the correlation between the different risks. Shipwreck risk varies over time. Some years had high risk and others low risk. And the main variable was the weather, which affects all the ships at the same time, but does not affect all the ships equally. Safely loaded ships tend to be impervious to bad weather, only have a slight increase in risk, whereas overloaded ships have a much greater increase. So overloaded ships are much more likely to sink in bad weather. If you look at the equivalent default risk, of course, that varies over time depending on economic factors such as interest. So if you think of the economy as being analogous to the weather, it's basically a system-wide risk factor that affects all the loans at the same time, but does not affect all loans equally. And subprime loans are much more likely to default in economic downturns. If you have prime loans, as they're called in the United States, they have low default rates in both good and bad economic conditions. Higher in bad economic conditions, but not much higher. Whereas for a subprime debt, the economic factors make a difference between a default rate of 0.5% and a default rate of 20%. So it's, if you draw a little graph to show what... To build this model, we actually need a graph showing the interaction effects between the load and the weather. So in this diagram, as long as the load is low, risk stays low. And as long as the weather is good, the risk stays low. But it's only when you have an interaction of a high load and bad weather that you get into trouble. So to build a model, you need to actually have a surface like this to show how the interaction works. Since the load and weather interact, that means the risks are correlated, which means that overloaded ships will have a higher correlation than the safety-loaded ships. If you think about mean value portfolio theory, you could say that the overloaded ships are the high beta stocks that are very sensitive to market conditions. So that might help you understand a bit of how the model works. As a result, diversification benefits are limited, especially for overloaded ships. So before the introduction of easily available insurance, there was still quite a lot of incentive for ship owners to be moderately conservative in their choice of load levels. Of course, the choice of the optimum load level in this model will depend on whether you make a correct assessment of the likelihood of bad weather and a correct assessment of the shape of that load and weather interaction. Now, it seems to me, reading some historical books, that financial markets quite frequently overestimate the diversification benefits. I mean, a lot of the books are saying that people underestimated the correlation between different residential risks when they were pricing CDOs. But I'm thinking back to the 1980s, it was the same mistake in the junk bond market. People thought, if I hold a diversified portfolio of junk bonds, that'll have a low risk. Well, it didn't have a low risk because all the junk bonds were basically in highly leveraged companies, which were very susceptible to interest rate increases. So there was a kind of hidden correlation there. And the fact that they overestimated the benefits of diversification led to excessive risk-taking. Okay, so now I wanted to start looking at what happens when insurance comes into the picture. So the earliest insurance policies were called bottomry, and these go back thousands of years. And what happened with bottomry was the ship owner would borrow some money to buy the cargo. If there was no shipwreck, he would repay the loan with interest. But if there was a shipwreck, the loan would be completely written off as a non-recourse loan, we'd call it today. And the interest rate payable on the loan was, of course, reflect the risk of shipwreck. So that's pretty well the same as a special purpose vehicle, really. SPVs issue debt securities to obtain funds for home lending. The mortgage repayments cover the debt interest if they're made. If the home loan defaults, the SPV defaults, and the interest rate that's payable on the debt security reflects the underlying risk. So nothing new under the sun, really. The same methods of risk management have been around for couple thousand years. They just changed the name and the legal structure. So as soon as you introduce insurance, the profit function changes. Your wealth is the value of the ship plus the profit loading minus the premium rate, and that's a certain wealth. Now, the result on the loading decision depends, of course, on how the premium is determined. And I was surprised to discover in many cases the optimum load level increases. That is, the mere existence of insurance allowing people to diversify their risks and actually eliminate their risks is going to increase systemic risk. It depends on the form of the premium, but we'll get to that in a minute. So I was surprised to discover that I wasn't the first one to notice this. Back in 1601, when they were passing the first insurance laws, someone pointed out the advantages of insurance were that the loss lighteth rather easily upon many instead of heavily upon a few. But they also said one of the big advantages of having a good insurance system was that it would encourage merchants to take more risks. So they knew that back in 1601. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised at the introduction of the securitization market for home loans was likely to lead to an increase in risk. That's what insurance does. And they knew it back, Queen Elizabeth knew it, because she's the one who, the first Queen Elizabeth knew it, because she's the one who was in charge when they passed that law. Okay, so what I tried to do is say, how would the load level change depending on the premiums that are payable? And I said, okay, if you just charge the risk premium, then the load, with no extra loading for risk at all, the load would go up to 133, same as profit maximization. And increasing the percentage loading leads to a reduction in the optimum load level. Now, of course, we all know, being dedicated actuarial people, that just adding a percentage onto the risk premium is not a very good way of allowing for risk. We have to use much more sophisticated methods of allowing for risk margins, and you can use all those complicated Wang transforms and proportional hazards and variance-weighted forms. So theoretically, the premium should include some kind of fair value risk margin so that the insurance company gets a fair return for the risk he's taking. And I thought, well, I could try out all sorts of different premium structures to try and find out what would be the impact on the load level for different types of premium structures. But I decided that probably was a bit of a waste of time in this case, because in practice, the people who were doing the underwriting had absolutely no idea what even the expected value, what the risk premium should be, because their underwriting standards were so poor that they couldn't tell a good risk from a bad risk, much less work out what the risk margin should be. So I said, okay, let's look at what really happened in a case where underwriting was not good at identifying good and bad risks. They didn't have any idea of the correct risk premium for any individual ship, so they charged the same premium rate for everybody. And the way they survived was that they insured, the Lloyd's underwriters insured lots and lots of ships for small sums insured. They knew that there was a mix of good and bad risks, but they assumed that the good risks would subsidize the poor risks. And as long as the premium that they charged covered the average risk, they would still be profitable. It's just like a group life insurance policy. You don't check on the health of every single person you're insuring, because it would be too expensive. So this system works out okay. And maybe the same things happened in securitization. People knew they were buying a package of good and bad risks, but they assumed that on average they'd get their money back. Now, unfortunately, the effect of this is that the optimum load level goes right off the chart. I mean, if you're going to be charged the same premium no matter how risky your ship is, then the most sensible thing is to load your ship right up to the maximum until it is just barely above water level. And that's exactly what happened. Mr. Plimsoll told stories of some poor woman who went out to say goodbye to her husband who was sailing on this ship, and she said goodbye to him, and she stepped off the deck into a dinghy. She didn't have to jump, she just stepped off the deck straight into the dinghy that was rowing her back to shore, because the ship was only like 2 feet out of the water. And, of course, she never saw her husband again, because his ship sank before it got very far and was never seen again. So The effect of this premium structure is that the ship will be loaded to the absolute maximum that it can possibly take as far as risk goes. The people who own the ships have every financial incentive to maximize the risk. Now that leads to our classic adverse selection spiral in insurance. Okay, the Lloyd's underwriters charging the same premiums for... Charging the same premiums for both good and bad risks. So the good risks are subsidizing the poor risks. That means that the risk-taking ship owners are making lots more money at the expense of the responsible ship owners. The responsible ship owners are gradually either forced out of the market or forced to copy the bad practices of the more reckless ship owners. As the good ship owners drop out, the average risk in the market increases. That means that the insurers who don't react quickly enough will become insolvent. And eventually the premium rates will have to increase to cover the increasing risk in the market. It's the only logical way for people to respond. So I think you can see that in the subprime debt market. These are just a couple of graphs showing how the percentage of low-doc loans increased between 1999 and 2007. And the second one shows the increase in the percentage of loans that had high loan-to-value ratios. I mean, it started at about 10% in 1999 and boosted up to more than 50% just 8 years later. Now, if that's not an adverse selection spiral, I don't know what else is causing it. The result of an adverse selection spiral is that premiums go up, the cost of transferring risk goes up throughout the market, and that's exactly what happened back in 1867. This is a ship owner complaining that the high level of shipwrecks are causing sharp increases in the premium rates for insurance compared to 20 or 30 years ago. The premiums had doubled, and even at double the premium rate, the underwriters were still finding it difficult to make a profit. So you can see the weaknesses in the insurance system create an increase in systemic risk, which has the inevitable result of pushing up risks and premiums all through the market. And, of course, then we get to speculation. As soon as there's an inefficient insurance market, which means that risks are mispriced, obviously there's an opportunity for someone to make a profit, right? If you know that you can buy insurance at a cheap rate, it becomes profitable to speculate, even if you don't own the ship. If you know a ship is in pretty poor condition, quite likely to sink, and you can buy an insurance policy at a cheap rate, you can make a profit. The only requirement is you have to have inside information about how risky that ship is so that you know more than the insurer. If you know more than him, you can make a profit doing this. In the 1860s, this appeared as an increase in wager policies, that is, policies where there was no insurable interest. But, of course, in more recent example in the credit markets, there was an absolute boom in speculation in all sorts of credit-related products. Now, if that's not a symptom that there's some mispricing somewhere, I mean, why do people speculate? Because they think that the securities are mispriced. And the insiders... tend to have an edge when it comes to speculation. So I don't know how many of you read the newspapers, but of course the SEC is now having a case against Goldman Sachs saying they put together a lot of these packages of securities. They had inside information. They didn't disclose this to the people they were selling it to. What do you expect will happen in a speculative market? So the question is, okay, bad pricing in insurance causes systemic risk. So the question was, why were they so bad at pricing? Why were they so inefficient in underwriting the risks? And the answers are basically the same in 1860 and in 2008. First is just information asymmetry. The ship owners had control of the ship construction process. And they cut corners on the costs. Plimsoll describes these things called devils, which were little bolts that they put in to hold the ships together. And a well-constructed ship had bolts made out of copper. But if you were a cost-cutting ship owner, you'd make the bolt out of iron and just put a little bit of copper on the end where it showed. After a while, a ship made with these devils, the iron would corrode, the bolts would not be holding the ship together anymore, and it would just come to pieces somewhere out in the middle of the ocean with disastrous results. And the thing is that it's impossible to detect these construction faults from the outside. Someone who came along and looked later would see the copper bolt on the head on the bolt, and they would never know. And I think that's pretty well the same as the home lenders market. The home lenders control the process of approving loans. Weaknesses in these managements, in the management of this, is not apparent to anyone who just inspects the paperwork later on. I know there were a lot of companies that specialized in checking the subprime debt, but how would you really be able to tell if there was a bad property valuation that overstated the value of the property? How would you know? And especially when there were some companies which really were pathetically bad at disclosing stuff. So, for example, Countrywide is currently, some executives at Countrywide are being sued by the SEC for failing to disclose their increasingly lax underwriting guidelines. They changed the definition of prime loan so that they could claim that they were selling a lot of prime loans, but they weren't really prime loans according to anybody else's definition except for theirs. They had a high percentage of loans with loan-to-value ratios above 100%, and they even broke their own pathetically weak underwriting guidelines. But no one outside the company was aware of this. And so what chance did investors, who were the source of funds for these Countrywide loans, really have to make an accurate assessment of the loans? Next problem was diversification. Each insurer only underwrote a small amount on any ship, which means it was expensive, and it was expensive to inspect ships, so they just didn't bother. If you only have $100 exposure to any ship, you're not going to spend $50 inspecting the ship to make sure it's in good condition. And this is a quote from John Talbot, who wrote 86 Lies on Wall Street, a very entertaining book. He said the same problem affected the securities market. Large institutional investors thought that they were protecting themselves by diversifying, but they were so diversified that they didn't have time to inspect the risk and return for every security that they owned. The solution to the information asymmetry problem is to have collective risk assessment, like credit rating agencies, that will do one credit assessment and then share the results with hundreds of different underwriters so that they can each have access to good quality information. Now, this didn't work in the 1860s for exactly the same reasons it didn't work 3 years ago. The Lloyd's Register was the classification agency which inspected and classified ships. Their revenue came from the ship owners. The ship owners complained that they were too strict, and other registers were set up which undermined the classification standards. This is a quote from, we won't go through all of it, but basically there was an alternative organization set up called the Liverpool Underwriters Association, and they gave favorable treatment in classification to any ship which was built in the Liverpool shipyards, and they just made their risk assessments more and more lenient in order to get business away from the Lloyd's underwriters. And of course, Lloyd's then had to reduce their credit rating standards in order to compete with the Liverpool underwriting standards, until the standards for shipbuilding just slowly declined. Of course, that parallels to what we see in the SEC's report on credit rating agencies during the subprime debt crisis. Never put anything in an email, right? Okay, because the SEC went and read all these emails back and forth from the rating agencies where they were correspondence between different employees saying we have to cut our rating methodology and make it more lenient because otherwise we're going to lose customers. And they've got documented cases where that's exactly what the credit rating agencies were doing. So the competition between the credit rating agencies led to more and more trouble. I know I'm running out of time, right? Okay, next problem was what I call an influx of naive capital. During the early 1860s, the marine insurers had a bit of an underwriting cycle. There was a civil war in the United States, which meant that everybody who usually bought insurance in the U.S. bought it from the U.K. They had a few years of really good profitability, which meant that a whole bunch of new insurance companies entered the market to cash in on the wonderful profits. They started all fighting for market share. The new insurance companies didn't really have much experience in underwriting. They cut their premiums, and then everybody, all the other insurers also cut their premiums. All the new insurance companies were out of business within 5 years, but, of course, by then it was too late. They'd been selling underpriced insurance for quite some time. Same problem in the subprime debt market. Most of the money that was flowing in to the subprime debt market was coming through securitization. There was rapid growth in sources of funds coming in. The worst risks were sold to the least sophisticated investors, who, of course, lost heaps of money. The impact of rate cutting, according to our model, would be that providing cheap insurance to bad risks just gives more incentive for people to take on more risk. So the underwriting cycle will lead to an increase in systemic risk. Now, the solution to asymmetric information is to have utmost good faith in the insurance markets, or in debt markets we'd call it disclosure. But in practice, of course, these requirements are very difficult to enforce. And Plimsoll said the insurance companies theoretically could sue people who overloaded their ships and sent unseaworthy ships to sea. But in practice, it was impossible. It was much too expensive to go to court. The chances of winning were, you know, a bit of a gamble. All the proof of what happened was at the bottom of the sea, so you couldn't prove that they'd been misleading you. And the witnesses, any survivors from the shipwreck or anyone who saw the ship leaving port, would be reluctant to testify because then they'd never get another job in that industry again. So the question is, we have these disclosure requirements, we have these utmost good faith requirements, but if they can't be enforced, will the market really ever be efficient? A lot of people are now suing the people who sold them CDOs and claiming that there was misrepresentation, but I don't know what their chances are of actually winning the case if you don't have an effective legal system to enforce it. Okay, solutions. Quick solutions. First one was, Plimsoll's main goal was to save the lives of the sailors. He didn't really care whether the insurance companies went broke. And he had a very simple solution, just set standards and enforce them. Set standards for shipbuilding, set standards for crew sizes, set standards for load levels. And that was the introduction of what's famously called the Plimsoll line. They just painted a line on the side of the ship. If you couldn't see the line, the ship was overloaded. Very straightforward. Similar proposals currently in front of the U.S. Congress is that our main goal is to protect the home borrowers. We don't care about the investors who invested in CDOs. We care about the people who are being chucked out of their houses due to foreclosures. And there have been suggestions that we should set minimum home lending standards to prevent any predatory lending. These are proposals that are currently being discussed in the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency in the U.S. and the FSA in the U.K. Stuff like no more low-doc loans, no more negative amortization loans, no more inflated property values, no more excessive LTVs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And to protect the investors, no one would be allowed to sell or transfer a mortgage without guaranteeing that these standards had been satisfied. So that's one of the proposals under discussion. Sorry. Better collective risk classification. I mean, the basic problem is that the risks are mispriced because no one can evaluate the risks properly, because the cost of collecting that information is too high relative to the summit risk. So collective assessment of the risk by a credit rating agency that is reliable is one of the ways to solve the problem. The problem is, if you have a fee-based business model and competition between rating agencies, it is very difficult to avoid a decline in the standards. Now, one of the early proposals was that the government change the business model. Instead of making it depend on fees from the ship owners, get some money from the government. They can charge a levy on all the shipping, give the money to the risk classification agencies, and that will eliminate the conflict of interest. But it didn't work because the government wasn't up for it. They said, thank you, but no thanks. We don't want to spend any more money on you. What really seems to have worked is that they got rid of the competition. Now, I don't think we could get away with this now, but we've got anti-monopoly type rules. But basically, the way Lloyd's Register solved this problem is they just took over all their competitors. Then they had a monopoly. The ship owners had nobody else who could classify their ships because Lloyd's was the only company in town that was doing it. They also provided publicly available detailed risk classification standards, which helps reduce the temptation to kind of let the standards slide a bit later on. And to deal with competition from the international registers, there were a lot of international agreements about setting safety standards. There are currently about 25 international registries for classifying ships, but they have a non-compete agreement. They will not compete on cutting safety standards. They'll compete on the level of service, but they won't compete by saying, we'll give you a better rate, better classification than anyone else. And, of course, they're non-profit, and they're jointly controlled by the underwriters and the ship owners. There's no shareholders involved. I don't think that's probably practical, but it's interesting to see that this is definitely not a perfect system, but it did seem to improve the standard of underwriting. The final solution is the skin-in-the-game suggestion. Mr. Plimsoll said that no one should be able to insure more than two-thirds of the value of a ship, and that removes the financial incentive to overload. And many countries did have such a requirement. Same thing's happening in our current subprime debt crisis. There is the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which has been passed by the House of Reps in the US. It has not passed in the Senate, which says that every company which sells mortgage-backed securities would have to keep 5% of the risk. Now, the question is about that 5%. Where does that number come from? George Soros, who's in favour of this proposal, said 5% is not enough, probably should be at least 10%. Well, this is a very controversial proposal, and of course there'd be a lot of difficulties in making it work in practice. One of the questions is 5% enough? Do you need 10%? Maybe even higher? And what effect, if we did introduce such a requirement, can we predict whether it would really solve the problem? And I think that's the advantage of building a model like the model that I've developed here, which is full of completely dodgy numbers. But I think this would be a kind of approach to solving that problem. If you can define the risk function, the relationship between the load and the weather and the risk, the weather distribution, the profitability that you can earn by taking on more of a load, the amount of risk aversion, and most importantly, the insurance premium structure, then you can actually work out in this model what the impact would be on the optimum load of varying the retention levels. So that graph just shows... stop now. Okay, I'm right at the end. Assuming the advantage of using the model is that you can try and make a prediction. Of course, all those functions would be difficult to predict. You can also find out the equilibrium. This is a dynamic model, assuming that everyone reacts. The model can be used to predict what would be the equilibrium levels of risk-taking and the equilibrium insurance premium rates. I should point out, my last slide, Plimsoll had a terrible, terrible time getting any reforms through the government. He said the people who profit the most from this overloading are very vigilant to resist change. They are determined, energetic, and sleeplessly vigilant. They were relentlessly lobbying Parliament to prevent any changes in legislation. Not surprisingly, many of the members of Parliament were themselves quite wealthy ship owners who were making quite a lot of money from the death and destruction that was being caused everywhere else. It took Mr. Plimsoll and his colleagues 20 years to persuade the government to pass the load line requirement, which involved nothing more expensive than painting a line on the side of the ship. And even after he persuaded the government to do so, the ship owners spent the next 30 years trying to get the changes reversed and to water down the load line requirements so that they could load up their ships even more. My conclusion is the main thing we learn from history is that no one learns anything from history. The same mistakes that happened in 1860 are still evident in dysfunctional insurance markets 150 years later. That's about it. Any quick questions? I took up all the time. Sorry.
There is still time for a couple of questions, so who'd like to be first?
No,
yes, it's working.
I think they'll want to go and have a coffee now.
Here's one.
Bruce Thompson. Did Plimsoll have bad press in his time, or did it take him 20 years to become a hero?
Oh, no, he was extremely popular. I mean, he was... One thing about him is he was extremely good at PR. I mean, he held public meetings. This book he published, Our Seamen, was like a bestseller in 1873. I don't know if they had a bestsellers list, but he had a great deal of public support. But in those days, you know, sailors didn't even have the vote. And he was a very effective political campaigner. He went to marginal electorates and talked to the MPs and said, I'm going to campaign in your electorate if you don't vote the way I want. So he was a very effective campaigner, but the government was the government of the day was very opposed. They said it's not the business of government to interfere with the business community. The market should be left to itself without too much red tape. If we impose too much regulation on the shipping industry in the UK, it will be uncompetitive with shipping from other countries. And anyway, it would be too hard to define safety standards because every ship is different and we could never get all the experts to agree. So they had all these really good reasons why the reform should not go through. And while the government was saying it was impossible to develop standardized load lines, Lloyd's Register, which was actually pretty influential, got a bunch of their marine engineering experts together and worked out a way to set safe load lines. So I guess the analogy would be that maybe it's up to the actuarial community to work out a much better way of assessing and measuring risk, and that would be a big step forward towards preventing this kind of crisis from happening again. Any other questions?
Well, I think that's the 5 minute bell. There's still some time for questions. Well, failing those questions, I'll on behalf of our audience, I'll thank you for a very interesting piece of really lateral thinking that
okay,
illustrates some very, very disturbing parallels, isn't it?
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming in, Liz.
Thank you very much.